This is Friday, March 23rd, 1995. It's about
10:30,
10:15 in the morning, and we are talking to Doug Adair about El Marquero, the United Farm Workers Organization Committee newspaper. And please present yourself.
Okay, my name is Douglas Adair, and I went to Delano in September of 1965. But El Marquero had actually been founded and the first issue printed, I think, in the fall of 1964.
Yeah, I think the first one was December of 64.
And it had, the cover had the character Danza Taco on the cover. And before the first issue was ever formed, Cesar Chavez and Tony Orendain and probably Gil Padilla, probably Dolores, I'm not sure who all were involved in the first issue, had discussed the name, the type of newspaper they wanted. They wanted a small paper that would be cheap and could be distributed in little towns and barrios all up and down the county, all up and down the Central Valley. And I don't have a copy of the first issue. When I came to Delano in 1965, the strike broke out almost as soon as I got there. And we had a little tiny office, and there was just tremendous chaos. And we were dealing with the immediate crisis of the minute. And back issues at that time that hadn't been sold were just stacked under the table. And there was no order or anything for keeping them. And since my training had been in history, I realized right away that I wanted to save, that the early editions, copies of the early editions, should be saved. And I think either in the fall of 1966, probably in the fall of 1966, I packaged them up and took them down to my parents' house in Claremont. Also, we were expecting to be firebombed at any minute. I mean, it was a pretty chaotic situation.
No, was it kind of printed at the union office?
No, there? It was printed up in Fresno.
Fresno.
But when things settled down and we got a bigger office and had time to review what we had, we realized that we had only one complete set from volume one through the present, whenever that was. And there was only one copy of volume one, number one, and there was only one copy of the strike edition in English. And we actually reprinted the strike edition. But when I was there, we never reprinted number one. And in 1973, I turned over to Paul Chavez all the old back copies that I had, except for one set, which isn't complete. The complete set I turned over to Paul Chavez. And what you're looking at now and what I'm turning over to Cal State Northridge is what I saved for myself, for my own personal edition. So it doesn't begin with number one, it begins with number two. But there are complete sets. That complete set of the original should be, I assume, in Delano. There was a complete set at Wayne State. There was a complete set at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And then somewhere in the late 60s, we had the whole thing put on microfilm. So there is a complete set of these early editions on microfilm.
Yeah, there we found some of those.
We also, on our own initiative, took out a subscription for the Kern County Library. And for all I know, they threw them, but that was the initial idea that there would be a public copy available. So they might still have a complete set. But otherwise, these are pretty rare. Yeah.
What influenced, would you think, Cesar and Gil to come up with the characters and the ideology behind having the newspaper, you know, bringing the voice of the farm worker, or, you know, persuading the farm worker that this was an important issue to...
Well, they were very aware of the Mexican Revolution, and there was, and you probably know the name better than I, but there was a writer, Flores
Magón,
there you got it, who did a newspaper out of Los Angeles,
yeah,
I think,
in
Tijuana. They were familiar with that and the tremendous impact that it had in Mexico. They also subscribed to a paper that was being printed in Tijuana or Ensenada called the Comadre de la Contora,
yes,
or something like
yes,
that.
Yes.
And I don't know if you've ever run across it, but it apparently had been closed down repeatedly by the PRI, or the government authorities in Mexico, and it was originally La Contora, and then it was Hijo de la Contora, and then it was closed down again, and it became Comadre de la Contora. And when I saw it, there were all these little parrots across the masthead, and each one of them had their beaks tied shut by government officials. And then here was the new one squawking away. And so they came up with the idea of El Malcriado, was the idea of kind of the child that just didn't respect authority. It was kind of the bad child that, well, not necessarily bad, but just didn't know its place, didn't accept its place in life, didn't respect its elders and betters, didn't go along with the hierarchy of the world that was to be imposed on it.
It's kind of not the young person who's kind of rebellious and
exactly,
and mm-hmm. you know, not adhering to the status quo.
Right. And I think Cesar and Dolores knew Andy. I'm not sure where they first met Andy Cermeño, but he was involved from the first in defining the character that they wanted to present, which was in part serious, you know, and talking about the oppression of the farm workers, but was in part joking, and was in part funny, and was in part poking fun at politicians that claimed they were going to help the little brown people, and the University of California at Davis that was doing all this wonderful research to help the little brown people and the farm workers, and all these people from the city that claimed they wanted to help farm workers. And the Malcriado was made fun of them. I mean, let's be honest. These people are out for themselves, and they're using us to get their grants, or they're using us to get political power, but when it comes to doing anything for us, nobody's going to help us except ourselves.
So a lot of it was persuading people to kind of wake up and say that this is what's going on, bringing a political consciousness to
exactly.
the farm worker and making them think about their situation.
Exactly. And so the first two issues both had these cartoon covers. The first one was Don Sataco, the second was Don Coyote. And the third edition goes back to revolutionary Mexican art. And Cesar used a lot of this in the early editions, Cesar and Tony. And I think Tony was also quite involved in these early editions, Tony Orendain. And here's a cartoon of somebody writing on the wall and in the bathroom.
So a lot of these first issues were put together by Cesar, and then they were done in English and then translated?
I doubt there was any English involved in this. I think Bill Escher became the editor and did the typing. But it's my impression that the Spanish is Caesar's in most of these. And if he didn't write it, all of it, he discussed it with Bill, and then Bill would write it down. And certainly the editorials would have been either Caesar or Tony's. And from the first, there was a lot of looking back to the Mexican Revolution. And of course, there were people in Delano and the Central Valley in 1965 that had ridden with Pancho Villa, that had fought with, I don't remember anyone that fought with Zapata, but there were plenty of people from Zacatecas and Coahuila and Chihuahua that either they or their parents had known Pancho Villa, had seen Pancho Villa. And there were people in Delano that had experienced moments in the Mexican Revolution when they, as campesinos, had ruled their own villages, and there had been no landlords, and there had been no government from Mexico City. And they had had an experience that may have been brief, and it may have been with either preceded by or followed by terrible bloodshed, but they had had experiences when these villages were free villages, and no one from the city told them what to do or taxed them. They could do what they wanted. The land was theirs. They could do what they wanted with the land. And once again, as a people, we found ourselves, but I'm really referring to the Mexican Americans in the Central Valley, found ourselves in a situation where huge landlords and, in effect, haciendas were controlling our lives, and the courts and the church and the judges and the police and everyone seemed against us. But in the memory of living brothers and sisters and uncles and grandfathers, we'd fought back. And we'd won, at least temporarily, and si se puede, we could do it again. And there was this feeling that organizanse raza, you know, get it together, that if we come together as brothers and sisters, we can build this new society or regain the dream of the Mexican Revolution. I got the impression that though there was more personal knowledge of Pancho Villa than of Zapata, that it was Zapata that was the one that was really admired in the community, that there was so much violence involved with Pancho Villa's victories and so much destruction. And then at the end, it seemed he made compromises with this politician or that politician, and somehow Zapata had been truer to his own home village and his own community, and had been less seeking the glories of the national stage. I mean, he went to Mexico City and he went home. He went back to, where is it, Morelia or wherever he's from. And he wasn't interested in national power. He was interested in the village controlling its own life.
The people.
Mm-hmm. And I think Caesar and Dolores and Gilbert were also very strongly influenced by the Catholic worker and the idea of nonviolence, in part because the Mexican Revolution had been so violent and had taken such a tremendous cost in blood, that the victory was compromised, that by 1920, Mexico was exhausted. They just wanted peace, and they were willing to accept the peace that the PRI offered just because the bloodletting had to stop. And so Caesar and Dolores and Gilbert from the first were pushing a nonviolent struggle, that yes, we're the sons of Zapata, but our struggle is going to be nonviolent.
So a lot of the first issues talked about things like that, and they also portray or...
And to tell the truth, I'm going to let you read them, because some of these I've never read,
okay,
to be perfectly honest.
Well, going back to the nonviolence, they're also talking about organizing in the papers?
And constantly about organizing, and get it together, and... this is a little joke story about Don Coyote, and but read through them. I noticed one thing in just glancing through them. The association was of local people. You've got to understand that. It's families that lived in Delano and Early Mart and so forth. And the community was, and the newspaper was, it was the voice of the farm workers. Let's see, La Voz del Campesino is, this is number 7, number 6, 5, 4, okay, 3 doesn't have anything. Number 2, it says, Dedicado para los trabajadores agrícolas. So La Voz del Campesino appears on number 4, is the first time that appears.
So basically the first one was kind of the inaugural one, talking about this is dedicated to them, and then it started evolving into
this is our voice.
Mm-hmm. So the Marquero started bringing in more community folk and influencing the articles and the artwork within the paper.
Well, a lot of the artwork is still Mexican Revolutionary artwork. Cesar had a portfolio of these pictures and began using them. And of course, when I came on, I loved it. I kept it going because I just thought it was tremendous art.
So how did you become involved with the Malcriado?
Well, I'll get to that in a little minute. Okay. We're almost there. But you will notice references to wetbacks. That the community here saw people from this coming up from Mexico and breaking the strike that were illegals, and all of these were local people. And looking at it today, 1995 and Proposition 187, you know, and it looks like a kind of derogatory term, but remember that these were local families that were, they saw this as a threat. They saw the braceros as a threat, that the bracero, that we could never get anywhere until the bracero program was ended. Here's an article on welfare and how welfare is used to control the people. Our attitude towards welfare was, we wouldn't need welfare if the growers paid a living wage. And we'd also do articles on welfare rights, that you have a right to this and you have a right to that. But generally, the union in the early days was not in favor of welfare, that welfare was taxpayers' money letting the grower off the hook, and that really the grower should be paying the living wage. And I'm just going to zip through these a little faster, but here is the Huelga en las Rosas. This is the first big strike of the union, and I think, let's see if there's a date in it. Sometimes they're dated and sometimes they're not. But this would have been in the spring of 1965. And I think
I have a question.
Mm-hmm.
The advertising, mm-hmm. is that just, you know, mom and pop type of
little mom and pop stores? Dan's Market was an old gay Anglo in Delano that had a liquor store, and like the union, then some of them, let's see if any of these, let's see, like this one, has a hole in the corner. The way we distributed them, we cut up coat hangers and poked a hole through the corner with a ice pick and would put them on the coat hanger, and we could hang it from the candy or gum rack in these little mom and pop stores right close to the cash register. And it was on, consignment, that we would go back and pick up the ones that weren't sold, and it sold for a dime, and they would give us a nickel for the ones that were sold. And they were distributed from Arvin and Lamont in the south, Pumpkin Center, we had a little store, all the way up to Madera in the north. And I initially came to work for El Macriado because Bill Escher wanted someone to go around all these little stores. It was getting so time-consuming, and put the paper in the stores. And the nickels, you know, you drive 20 miles to some little barrio and you would have sold 23 papers, you know, and you'd have $1.15. I mean, it was borderline paying for the gas. and the ads paid for the printing. But the union wasn't putting any money into it because the union didn't have any money. There were no, for your dues, you got a subscription. But in fact, the union didn't have any money to put into it.
Did the union also want to keep some legal distance in case of
law? Initially, no. Initially, that wasn't a consideration. But that did become a consideration later. And it says in these, it's printed by the Farm Worker Press. Well, what's the Farm Worker Press? The Farm Worker Press, as far as I know, initially had no paperwork, no nothing. It may have been when you're sending something through the mails, you have to have a fictitious name form that you file with the county. And it may have been that the Farm Worker Press was invented to go on that fictitious name form, doing business under a fictitious name. Because if you collect money from someone from out of state, you have to have an address filed with the county of some legal entity that's collecting the money and doing the business. So that's probably where the Farm Worker Press came from. And then when the strike started and the newspaper began to get sued, it was convenient for the union to be able to say we had no control over what was printed in the paper. And the truth was, those of us working on the paper would type it up and take it to press, and the first Caesar or Dolores would see it was after it was printed. The truth was they didn't really control it by that time. But in these early editions, almost every edition, either Caesar and I think I keep saying Tony because I think he was involved quite a bit, but Caesar and Tony would sit down with Bill Escher and go through all the issues that they wanted to bring up and the line that they wanted to take. And then in the spring, and this would probably be, you could probably get a date for this somewhere, the strike in the Roses. But I think it was like April or May. Oh, here it is, the 3rd of May. And here's the whole story. Mount Arbor Roses. And I think they just re-signed a contract this week with the successor company of that. History comes full circle. But the guy that was the fastest and best and más valiente of the rose workers was a guy named Epifanio Camacho. And he was some kind of Pentecostal. I don't think he was Jehovah's Witness, but he was not Catholic. And in those days, people in the Mexican-American community that were Protestants tended to be rebels that had rebelled for some reason against their dads or the church or whatever. And there were many, many people in the Union that looked on the Catholic Church from the historical perspective of Mexico as being part of the establishment, part of the terrible system of Diaz, Porfirio Diaz, and so forth that had oppressed the workers for centuries. And so there were people that hated the church or had contempt for it. But Caesar was very, very Catholic. And this, and early, right before the strike, one of the first English editions, I noticed there was a letter from him thanking people for their prayers and when he'd been sick and that those that had said a rosary or something or other. Caesar was very Catholic. Dolores was, on her second husband, and that marriage had also come apart, was Catholic, but I thought of her much more in the tradition of the Catholic worker as a rebel, and certainly not taking orders from any priest as to how she should live her life. And the priests in the Central Valley were, in those days, were not interested in farm work. So that while there's a lot of kind of Catholic-oriented stuff in the paper, because it's the community is predominantly Catholic, Catholic how to put it, there's also an anti-clerical tradition in the paper. And when I came on, La Voz del Campesino to me meant you represent the voices of these different elements. And it's certainly one of the strongest leaders among the Rose workers was not Catholic, was Pentecostal of some kind.
That would fit back into your other contact with the Mexican Revolution, you know, the Zapata Dia, because there's also an over-representation of the small Protestant group in Mexico in the anti-Porfirio Diaz, especially the early days.
Mm-hmm.
Many of them came from the already dissident in the Protestant Catholic.
I hadn't known that.
Yeah,
but
it's an interesting cycling back. Mm-hmm. We may actually have some, it'd be interesting to pursue that and see if maybe there'd be some generational contacts there of people who would involve some other things.
And my partner here is a Jehovah's Witness. And there's a whole circle of his friends that are, and they're strong union members, but the union now has problems with them because the union is so Catholic oriented and there's always a mass and there's always, but also a problem with the Jehovah's Witnesses politically because the union is very involved in politics and we're going to support this politician and hand out leaflets for that politician. And of course Jehovah's Witnesses say, what a waste of time. They're all, you're not going to get any good coming out of those people, forget it. So there's a little bit of friction now between the union and some of these. And a number of real strong union people, when they leave the union, leave staff, it's to go into one of these Protestant sects and become, for instance, a minister. I know one of the leaders of the strike here in Coachella in 73 became a minister of one of these little sects. And he was learned how to stand up in front of the people and speak and speak his mind. And anyway. And here's an early cartoon, and the cartoons, I think, were mostly, would have been, Andy Zermanio was a great artist, but would kind of wait for Caesar or Bill Escher to send down an idea. And this shows the fat grower with his mint julep, and the contractor sitting up in the tree, and here is Don Sataco with the axe, and the axe is labeled La Huelga, whacking away at the tree. He's finally beginning to get the idea. This is the kind of thing that got us in trouble all the time, is that they took the AFL-CIO symbol and they used whiteout to eliminate any reference to the AFL-CIO and put in Asociación Nacional de Trabajadores del Campo. Pan, trabajo, copyright. Dignidad. Viva la causa. This is one of Caesar's kids. I think that's Birdie. And then this is again in the roses. Huelga. Now this is the kind of issue that would get us kicked out of stores if the store manager knew what it knew what Huelga meant. But so this is where they've gotten a raise in the wages. And almost every editorial is un movimiento. And it's a movement. We're getting things together and things are starting to happen.
And you have a quote from the Papa Juan.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is issue number 11. So it would have been in May or June of 1965. They had a big campaign against a guy named Horonis, who was a labor contractor in the sugar beets. Women in the strike.
Were there a lot of women that were working in El Matiello?
There were women in the sugar beets at this contractor, Horonis.
But were there women working at the Mercado with
At this time, the staff was just Caesar and Bill Escher. Put out every issue. There was no secretarial staff. There was nobody else. And I would recommend when you're going to talk to Gil and Julio and the people in, especially Gil and Julio, old timers, if you've read through these and are familiar with these different issues, and if you can get Camacho. Camacho later got hooked up with some heavy rev group, Trotskyists or Maoists or Albanians, or I don't know who all. And I think Caesar, he got kind of bitter at Caesar, and Caesar kind of bitter at him. But certainly in the early years of the Union, a key figure in the Union. And at the meeting of September 16th, Caesar gave a kind of, how do you say, roundup of where the strike was and what the Filipinos were doing, and just a kind of general information talk, as I remember. And then it was Camacho that got up and gave the really fiery speech that we are the sons of Zapata, and it's better to die on our feet than live on our knees, and it's time to unite with our Filipino brothers. And Caesar was not sure. Well, we assumed we were going to go on strike. But at that point, Caesar was leaving it up to the workers, you know, look, we got $85 in the treasury. You know, if you think this is going to be easy, they're going to throw everything they've got at us to defeat this strike. And I think, as I remember, and again, my Spanish was pretty shaky. I was at that meeting. But as I remember, Caesar was trying to be very calm and honest with the workers, that this isn't some romantic thing, you know, where you're going to go out on strike for a day and win. And then it was Epifanio Camacho that said, you know, but this is what we've got to do, and the time has come, and let's go for it. And they'd had the experience in the Roses where they had gotten a wage raise. They hadn't won the written contract, but they'd gotten a wage raise. But the rose growers blacklisted Camacho. He didn't get his job back.
What type of influence did Mercado have as soon as it started hitting, you know, little shops with community members and workers? What type of response did you,
well,
you guys
Macriado, El Macriado, when I came on, which was like August and September, El Macriado was better known than the association. This was in little stores all up and down the valley, and people would buy it, and Caesar was the editor of El Macriado, was how they knew Caesar. I mean, and he had a little group down in Delano. He had an office in Delano. But there was no union. I mean, it was just an idea, basically, and just a handful. And we would have, how many members would we have in Richgrove? Well, we might have 6 members or 8 members that were paying $350 a month in dues. But we might sell 200 copies in Richgrove. The paper was reaching into many, many, many homes that were not yet members.
So essentially, the Mercado kind of started rolling the ball for the organization and people knowing about Cesar, and eventually later on, the union.
Right. There was no radio program. There was no mention of the union on the radio or in the press or on TV. The Macriado was the little, our foot in the door in all these little towns. And then Caesar and Dolores and Gilbert were all going house to house and meeting with people. In those days, Caesar would take off 2 days to drive up to Huron and meet with the family and talk to a worker one-on-one. And of course later, Caesar was meeting with popes and politicians and third world dictators. But in those days, it was one-on-one, Caesar, and it was worth it to him to spend a day to talk to a guy that was a good guy in Huron or Coalinga or, you know, some, I shouldn't put down Fresno County, but some godforsaken little town out on the west side, you know, that My gosh, you drive through it and you think...
Tranquility.
Tranquility, there. Yeah. There was some kind of housing project in Three Rocks, way out. I think David Burciaga was involved in that. And in these little towns, we would have two or three members, maybe five members. You know, it's a pretty good membership in Corcoran. We've got 20 members in Corcoran or Hanford. But the El Macriado would be in, say, six or eight different stores, and we'd sell 20 here and 23 there and 14 here and 19 there. And there were people in Woodlake that knew about us. There were people in Parlier that knew about us. There were people in, gosh, I'm trying to remember the name, Yedham. You know, little tiny towns that are, I mean, they're hardly a blip on the map. You know, you drive through them, you sneeze, you missed them. But there'd be a little store out in the barrio, and there would be El Macriado, and with the grower on his knees in number 11, and the workers surrounding him with their picket signs, Huelga. And so when the grape strike broke out, there was a little core in all of these communities that knew about the union, that knew what we were talking about.
The first organizer was the newspaper.
Right. Mm-hmm. This is number 12. This is one of my favorites. It has, poor Don Satako is lying in the hospital bed and he's hooked up to the blood machine, but the blood is being drawn out of his veins and up into the thing, and then it goes to the contratista and the patron.
That looks like early cartoons of Cantinflas.
Mm-hmm. And it may have, Andy, if you catch up with Andy, I think Andy's, I'm sure he's still alive. Again, he was intimately involved in these early editions of the Macriado.
You know, I'm looking at these, the pictures and images, and the characters, it also looks like Teatro Campesino were heavily influenced by these characters.
Oh, yeah.
And mm-hmm. portrayed into their
right.
character.
And a lot of thought, Caesar and Andy, I know, had put a lot of thought into these characters before they ever did the first issue. And what kind of, it's not what kind of member we're appealing to, but this is the union member. And he's not a heroic guy, you know, he's not a real young guy. He's kind of middle-aged, he's kind of downtrodden, he's been working all his life, and he's never gotten anywhere, and he's never going anywhere, and it's not his fault. And then, whose fault is it? And this is the first article on the rent strike, and this is Linnell Labor Camp. Now, this is where I lived, and so this is probably in about June. And this was my first contact with El Macriado. It would probably have been this edition, but I didn't read much Spanish. So, yeah, number 12. And here's Jim Drake and Gil Padilla, and they're organizing in the camps. I lived in a little house like this. And this is saying it's perfectly legal to have a rent strike.
So you think that Cesar and Gil and Dolores really understood the impact that this paper was
going to have? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah. And it's... I later became known as El Macriado. That was my nickname after I was running the paper. But it was... It was Caesar's idea. I think the paper even Gilbert and Dolores and others were key to organizing the union, but the paper was really Caesar's idea. And as far as the editors go, he was the best. And I think one of the problems that he had with me later was he knew how to put out a great paper that was funny, that grabbed people, that caught their attention, that got the message through. And when I goofed up or made mistakes, I mean, he noticed, couldn't hide it. And
so what was Sister's kind of influence in trying to, his style in putting these papers together, you know, how was he able to talk to the campesino? Was it the type of writing, perhaps? I think a lot of it, it would seem to me, is just the imagery, you know, the visual imagery with the characters where people can understand. I mean, I would imagine...
Cartoons, jokes, letters, keep the article short, get to the point. And this is not somebody talking down to you. This is not some professor from the college telling you how you should live your life.
Right.
It's not some priest telling you how you should live your life. It's a brother farm worker kind of joking about how our lives are and also always offering, with usually with the editorial, the possibility of this dream, you know. That
does the paper reflect Cesar's personal sense of humor? Did he have that highly developed sense of humor?
And there's an article here. Well, it's in the English edition later, but one of my favorites. And I think Bill and Escher and Cesar wrote it together and just cracked up over it. But it's a visit of Don Sataco and his wife Remedios to Davis. And the scientists there show them the farm workers of the future. And they've developed this one with very short legs to pick lettuce, and this one with very long legs to pick dates, and this one with long fingers to to do something else. And it's a hilarious article.
I also find it interesting because, you know, I don't feel with the farm workers. I mean, a lot of farm workers, well, what was the literacy rate during that time? I mean, were we talking about first, second generation Mexican-American that just spoke Spanish, that read the paper, those that, you know, maybe recent immigrants that...
Our competition was Alarma. That was the other Spanish-language magazine that was in all these little stores.
Right.
And people would buy Alarma and or El Macriano. But Alarma was in all these little stores, too. And when we began bringing out the English edition, which was just before I moved to Delano, it was for the younger Chicanos that had gone to school here and that read English better than Spanish. They spoke Spanish, but they read English. That was the idea of the original English edition. But all of these, and this is still number 13, and this would be like June, July of 1965, it's only printed in Spanish, and I think they're running about 2,000 copies an edition now. And pretty much everything sold. This issue, number 13, it shows the government as blindfolded and the grower making all the moves on the chessboard. Well, who's going to win the game? I mean, obviously, the grower always wins when he's dealing with the government, because the government doesn't know what they're doing and they don't know the reality of the farm workers' life. But here's $1.40, su derecho. And starting to hammer away at this, that the government in Washington had come up with this idea on paper, if you wanted braceros in 1965, you had to offer them $1.40 an hour. And for some reason, the growers agreed to that on the law, because they knew in reality they didn't have to. But some growers still wanted braceros. And I think in the melons, I've forgotten, in the grapes there were no braceros. But the strikes that began in the grapes, and when we go to lunch, we'll drive over by the David Friedman Company. The first strike in the grapes was at the David Friedman Company in May of 1965. And again, it was over this $1.40 an hour, that the government said $1.40 an hour should be the wage for American workers. And if you wanted braceros, you had to offer American workers that wage first. Well, even though there were no braceros in the grapes, people said $1.40, well, why aren't we getting that? And the Filipinos went on strike in May in 1965 and got it. And Coachella is such a small valley, you know, about 5,000 workers, and They started at the David Friedman Company, and Lionel Steinberg, who ran it, was in Democratic Party politics and a decent guy, liberal guy. He didn't give in because he was liberal and decent. He gave in because the workers stopped the thinning or whatever they were doing. I think it was in the thinning. But because he had kind of that political background, it wasn't like the end of the world to him. Okay, pay it. But when they moved up to Arvin in Lamont, the growers absolutely refused and arrested the whole picket line. And that's, I think, issue number 13. I think it's number, yeah, this is the strike in Arvin, number 17. So that's when the movement has gone up into the Central Valley. At this point, we're talking about $1.40, spreading the word, that's your right, demand it. But nobody was paying it. It was $1.25. So another of the themes was no more contractors, labor contractors. There's no reason for labor contractors. They're middlemen that are like buying and selling workers. And so it was a big campaign. Tangancikwaro, this was, I think, related to the Rose strike, and a lot of the workers had come from this town, and we had contacts there and went back to the town and told the people in the town, tell your compadres in the north not to break the strike. So there was this underground
network
communication, yeah. Our representative in Huron, Jose Esparza. Huron is...
Okay, continue.
And here's another article. Just cut out stuff and pasted it in. And some pretty girls.
Did they have any type of format that they for the advertisement, you know, besides Mohawk? Because what I see is, you know, tire advertisements, you know, Marbelias.
This was, this furniture store was absolutely crucial to printing the paper because they took a full page ad. But we had a lot of members in Corcoran. This was up in Corcoran. And sold a lot of newspapers there, so it was worth it to them.
And they never...
But they would decide what they wanted in their ad.
Right, but they ever complain about content?
No. Nope. This was a furniture store that dealt almost entirely with the Mexican community, so they didn't care. I've forgotten which... We lost this funeral home ad when the grape strike broke out.
And what issues this one is?
This is number 14. This would be in the summer of 1965.
So did you lose a lot of ads after when the strike began?
Not really. This chiropractor, I'm sure we lost him. And this was the big march in Visalia. This was the first union event that I participated in. So this is like the summer of 1965. And this was this a big issue. A little boy and a grower threw a plate at him. Well, you think. Gosh, the union now is on the world stage. But this was a real important issue to the members of Button Willow. Well, another little godforsaken town out in the middle of nowhere. But this poor little boy and the people will work, and El Macriado prints an article on it. And again, it's, you think looking back on it, what a little insignificant thing. But here, I'm sure for the first time ever in Button Willow, there was a newspaper saying, the growers, the gabachos, shouldn't treat us like that, shouldn't treat our kids like that, and he should go to jail. and the rent strike, and the tomatoes, and the growers are crying, they're going to lose $7 million. I think the tomatoes and the melons were the two crops where the growers were trying to get braceros that year. But in the background of all these papers is, on the national stage, the growers trying to keep the bracero program alive. I think Willard Wirtz was the Secretary of Labor at the time, saying, you've got to offer $1.40 an hour. And the growers would produce books that showed they were offering $1.40 an hour. Okay, in came the braceros. Like slave labor, not allowed to strike. If you strike, back to Mexico, right quick. Not allowed to protest about anything. They'd signed a contract in, where is it, Empalme or somewhere back in Mexico, and before they ever left, they were
already conditioned.
Right. Then here's Zapata on the cover. And Huelga. Huelga and La Uva. Now this is down in, this is the strike Gil Padilla did, and
okay,
they're pulling leaves.
Issue number 16.
Mm-hmm. This would have been like August.
August of 65?
Mm-hmm. And it's the Martin Ranch. J.C. Martin, that's right. It's in early March, but he also has stuff up around Woodlake.
Woodlake Exeter.
Mm-hmm, right.
Martin had a huge emperors.
Right, big operation. And these crews were mostly from early March. Gil Padilla had organized them. A lot of them were members. They all knew about the union. They'd all been reading in these earlier issues about, you know, $1.40 is your right. Well, they wanted $1.40. And he offered $1.25, and they went on strike. And I remember going down to this strike, and a good group of people. And so the grower right away went to labor contractors, and then we began picketing labor contractors in Visalia. There was one out of Visalia, I remember we picketed.
So now, this is now Gil becomes the editor, or is this or so?
No, he was, his office, he had a union office in Porterville, which was closer to where this strike was. And this was really, he knew, this was his strike. He knew all these people.
So that Cesar was, when did Cesar not write anymore for the
paper? He was still writing at this time. It was until this is Huelga and La Uva, but it's pulling leaves. It isn't quite the harvest yet.
Okay.
And this was a strike that eventually nothing came of it. And it became forgotten after the strike began in the harvest. But in a sense, Gil started the great strike, Gil Padilla, but not really, because the crew started it. And then they come to Gilbert, and Gilbert had organized them, and Gilbert said, you have a right to $1.40 an hour, and they said, we're going on strike. And he said, I'll help you. And so he was there to talk to the cops and to keep things nonviolent, as always. You know, the union always took the position.
So all the editorials that appear are still censored.
Probably Caesar's words.
Caesar's words.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Caesar's writing. But there's a lot of Bill Escher in these papers too, and I'm not quite sure where the line is. But they would sit down and say, what do we want to feature? So if they feature the little boy in Button Willow in this issue, that's Caesar's decision that, you know, looks pretty insignificant, but we have members there, and we want to assure the members in Parlier and the members in Madeira that they can't treat us like this anymore.
Right. And it also brings them in as members.
And just a real human element that, gosh, everybody, you know, we got little kids, we got grandchildren, nephews, and it was a very, how do you say, the personal is political, but just a very grassroots, family-level thing that we're all in this together, and this looks like a little insignificant issue, but it is significant. And stuff in the schools, and cops, just, and this is when Caesar's sick, so he may not have done that much on this issue, or he may have done more because he may have been at home and nothing to do and he's in bed. And then more on Mount Arbor and labor contractors and Cheese Made in Milan. Now, this is going to be another funny story, and I think we translated this into English later. I've forgotten what this one's about. But these are the history of Danza Taco. And this would be either Caesar or Caesar and Bill. But they would have sat down over a couple of beers and written this and gotten a few laughs, and maybe Helen would have come in and added something, and maybe Dolores, but mostly this would be Caesar's writing, Caesar's and Delicious.
Did Helen help a lot with some of these issues?
I don't think so. She did the credit union, and she had 10 kids, however many kids she had. She had her hands full. But I mean, the whole union office wasn't any bigger than this room. And you're working on a story, and everybody, you know, is adding a little bit or making a joke, or you heard a joke yesterday that she made, and you change it around a little bit, and it becomes part of the story. And in those days, there was no rush to get it done, because, well, there wasn't any prisa. You had,
right,
2 weeks, and you sit around, you have a beer. But things are beginning to heat up by this time. This would be August of 1965. And then the strike in Arvin and Lamont, again, this is the AWOC, it's not our strike. The strike at Martin Ranch was our strike. And this one, and I think they say, I think this is, they refer to the union here as La Union del Norte or something or other.
Les empleados como el gobierno está en contra de la gente campesina, la vergüenza de Arvin.
Yeah, here it is. La Huelga de la Union del Norte. And they call it that because the AWOC was based in Stockton.
So that's the Union del Norte was AWOC.
That's the AWOC. And the list of honor. But right away, no matter that they're not in our union, you know, that they're in some other union, we're all in this together. And there's the poor little boy again. And our strike, Nuestra Huelga, our strike's still going at J.D. Martin. And
letter to the governor.
Mm-hmm.
That continue the rent strike as well as...
Well, this strike? Is, yeah. I guess this is more about the rent strike. Yeah, this is about the rent strike. Okay, and the letter's from Gilbert to Governor Brown.
Es un hoyo en la tierra.
And this is by a black woman in Washington, I think.
Number 18?
Mm-hmm.
That's in 65 still?
Right. This would have been... This is the last issue before the grape strike breaks out, because the next one's a grape strike. So this would have been late August. This would have been early August and late August of 1965.
August is what number?
Early August would be number 17.
So it would come out every twice a month?
Twice a month, every 2 weeks.
Every 2 weeks.
Dignidad del Campesino. Then the grapes have fallen. The main headline is tomatoes, and it's politicians again. Oh, this is the one, the March of Science. And here's poor Danza Taco without any legs.
Interesting.
This is more on the rent strike.
And I've seen in the last couple of issues, what type of response were you getting? You know, you're getting a lot of letters from people.
Mm-hmm.
Gente piensa. What were people writing? You know, what were some of the responses to editorials, to the stories that you remember?
Well, these are all different and you can read them. I'm turning them over to you. Please print this letter in El Macriado. All the strike breakers are ta-ta-ta-ta, and they only think of themselves, and rather die of hunger than be a strike breaker. We want the $1.40 an hour, and so forth. Anyway, they're yours. This is the first one that's coming out in English. And so I would switch. Let me switch to English, and then I can tell you better what's in them. But this next edition, number 19, has Welgen Lauva. And this issue had been printed up, and this was the one that I was going to go down to Delano and help Bill Escher deliver. In fact, I may have even helped him deliver this one, because this one, the first issue in English was number 17, which had The Shame of Arvin in it. So let me take a break and go to the bathroom and then switch to English.
Now recorded. Yes.
Okay. So we've gotten to the grape strike. And the first English edition of El Macriado was number 17. And it was initially printed with the idea that a lot of the younger farm workers, especially that had been to school in the United States, they could read English better than they could read Spanish. And Spanish might still be the normal language of conversation, but there was a significant group of the community that read English. And so that was the initial reason for printing the edition in English. And I was hired to help on the English edition and also to help distributing the paper up and down the valley. And with the first edition in English, as I remember, Bill Escher said they got kicked out of maybe 20 or 30 different stores, because once the store owner could read the paper in English, we got kicked out right quick. There was also in this edition, number 17. Now, this is about the strike in Arvin. The government against the people. It's talking about immigration closed their eyes to the mass use of wetbacks in the melon harvest. The government signed papers to permit 8,000 braceros in the tomatoes, so forth. All of these things mean that the people have no voice in the government. In this country, they are supposed to have a voice. If we're willing to fight, we can have that voice. And now we are calling on you to help. You who read El Macriado, turn to page 8 to find out what you can do. And I assume page 8 says join the union. Let's see. You can help.
That's what the Cupidio did.
Mm-hmm. And then in this issue, I think it's about the dignity of the farm worker. And to me, these were very powerful editorials. I read them, and that's one of the reasons why I joined the union. For nearly all people, there is a thing that is more important than money. It's a thing called dignity, or self-respect, or honor. And it shows itself in many ways. Sometimes it is shown by the man who will fight when he is insulted. We poor farm workers have all been insulted. We have seen ourselves treated like cattle. We have seen how they have taken the work of our hands and bodies and made themselves rich, while we are left with empty hands between the earth and the sky. I'm sure this is Caesar's writing. We have seen our children treated as inferior in the schools. We have seen in the face of the cop our inequality before the law. We have known what it is like to be less respected, to be unwanted, to live in a world which did not belong to us. Our color or our language or our job have kept us apart. And the people who are profiting from our separateness are determined to keep it that way. It is a fact that in San Francisco, the Growers Association keeps an office full of people busy writing propaganda about how farm workers are all winos, bums, and incompetents. There is money in the advancement of these lives. We who are picking the grapes and the peaches and the tomatoes, which are the lifeblood of California, are soon going to share in the richness we have made. The little fights against the little grower and contractor that you read about today are only the beginning. The dignity of the farm worker shows itself in many ways. This year and in the years to come, it will be shown by the man who will fight when he is insulted. And then in number 19, when the grape strike is broken out and the Filipinos are already on strike, the editorial is enough people with one idea. What is a movement? It is when there are enough people with one idea so that their actions are together like a huge wave of water which nothing can stop. It is when a group of people begin to care enough so that they are willing to make sacrifices. The movement of the Negro began in the hot summer of Alabama 10 years ago when a Negro woman refused to be pushed to the back of the bus. Thus began a gigantic wave of protests throughout the South. The Negro is willing to fight for what is his, an equal place under the sun. Sometime in the future, they will say that in the hot summer of California in 1965, the movement of the farm workers began. It began with a small series of strikes. It started so slowly that at first it was only one man, then five, then 100. This is how a movement begins. This is why the Farm Workers Association is a movement more than a union. Once a movement begins, it is impossible to stop. It will sweep through California, and it will not be over until the farm worker has the equality of a living wage and decent treatment. And the only way it will be done is through organization. The farm worker must organize to fight for what is his. What is it? What is a movement? It is the idea that someday the farm worker will be respected. It is the idea that someday he will earn a living wage. It is when the silent hopes of many people begin to become a real part of life. And this would probably have been written before the Filipinos went out on strike. But gosh, I read stuff like that and I said, here I am, you know. What do you want me to do? I'm ready to work. Okay, now this is an article on the little strike that I was involved in. Exeter Dehydrator, and you have a leaflet for that. And that's probably the only leaflet in existence. Police beat up workers. Martin strike ends. And here's the government again, blindfolded. It's frequently in El Macriado, the government would be blindfolded, just that they don't know what's going on. They're just out of it. And the growers can get away with anything. There are letters here that may have been written by Bill Escher, I think. How do I join the union? Where do I send the money to? And then he says, dues go to P.O. Box 894. Because some of those, most of the letters are real letters, but some of them are he made up. And this one, okay, then here's a whole issue on the church against injustice. And Jack London's definition of a strike breaker. And when this strike broke out, David Havens was reading this at one point to the strike breakers and was arrested. That was a famous case. So this was the paper that we put the leaflet in. We put... this was printed and ready to go out, and we put a leaflet in, come to the meeting on... September 16th. So the article here is talking about 5,500 workers of AWOC, the AWOC Union of Stockton, living in camps, and the company's on strike. And Cesar Chavez immediately offered to help AWOC unconditionally. Chavez said, now is when every worker, without regard to race, color, or nationality, should support the strike and must under no circumstances work in those ranches that have been struck. As we go to press, Chavez has not received an answer to his offer of help to AWOC. I mean, we didn't quite know where we stood, but we didn't trust Al Green at all. We do hope that our offer of help will be received in the same spirit in which it was offered before it is too late, Chavez stated to El Macriado.
Well, this is what Chavez is still writing.
he wrote this. I'm sure he wrote this, or he and Bill wrote this.
And the articles are written by
probably, and by this time, and it's coming out in English. Probably Bill Usher wrote this.
What was Bill Usher's background before he came to
the Catholic? He came to the Union from the Catholic worker group in Oakland.
And did he work at writing for them?
Nope. He never had been a writer. I think he drove a bus. And they had worked up this project. They were going to take people to work in the fields and eliminate the labor contractor. And that was going to mean the workers would get better paid and blah, blah, blah. But in fact, workers still got screwed. And in fact, when there was no labor contractor, it was quite possible the grower, they would get out to the fields and the grower would lower the wage or whatever. And they were dealing mostly with very poor people out of Oakland, rhinos, all kinds of, you know, just, it wasn't a union, and it was the idea that if the contractor's eliminated, everyone will benefit, and a little bit, but needed a lot more than that. So, by this issue, starting to write articles. This is issue number 21, special free edition. And Caesar is way too busy from here on out. So Caesar's writing drops out almost entirely.
By issue 21.
After the strike breaks out, issue number 21. And so on these earlier ones, you'll really have to check with Bill Usher. But you could probably tell from the writing, Caesar was an eloquent writer in Spanish. And if the Spanish looks kind of, not as polished, it's probably Bill Usher writing or filling in. Then who wrote the Spanish in these issues? Well, we would grab anyone we could. And some of these early issues, the Spanish will be from 21, 22, 23, 24 in the fall. Some of them will be Luis Valdez, who was eloquent. Spanish was, all right, from what I hear, very, very good. Others, it'd be someone that came up from Los Angeles and brought a truckload of food, and can you write Spanish? We need this article translated. And we would just grab anyone we could. But so these issues from 21 on are written in English and then translated.
And then translated to Spanish. Mm-hmm. I see that it's a free special edition. You're saying that since I started concentrating more on the strike, and why did we have this?
This was just to get the word out.
Just to get the word out.
And we wanted everyone. And how did we deal with it in? I've forgotten how we dealt with it in the little stores. Because we distributed it everywhere, but we wanted people to take it. But I've forgotten how we dealt with it in the stores. I don't remember. But I know we handed this out in the fields. This was in lieu of leaflets.
Did circulation, did you go beyond 2,000 by this time?
Oh, yeah. We were printing, I think we started with 1,000 English, and by then we were already up to like 3,000.
1,000 English?
Spanish.
3,000 Spanish.
And then once the grape strike broke out, we began, I think we jumped up to 5,000 right quick. I've forgotten what the breakdown was. And initially the English was kept at 1,000, but very soon the English became our connection with people in the Bay Area and San Francisco. And this is Fina, Julio's wife. This is Caesar speaking in Delano, the Great Parade. Right.
This is George's photographs now?
Some of these, yeah. This is Manuel Rivera, who, if he's still in Delano, just a simple, decent, nice guy with a big family. They ended up in Toronto in the boycott. In fact, they ended up with my van, my car. This is Eugene Nelson, the grower's burying us in dust. Growers hit back with violence and brutality. That's the kind of headline I would have written. An appeal to mothers everywhere. Mothers Emergency Committee, the Farm Workers Association.
This is the one you started working on?
Yeah, this would have been the first one that I'd worked on a lot. Would have been number 21. And we never put our names in the paper. I don't think... It would be very rare that you would see my name in the paper, or Bill Escher's. I don't think Bill Escher's ever appeared in the paper.
When you started working on the paper, was it solely you who did the articles in English, and then they were translated, or were there other people working with you?
At this point, Bill Escher would have written most of it. My main job would have been typing, layout, and distribution. I was the mule, and he was more the writer. And I'd had some experience writing in my high school newspaper, but I wasn't a journalist. I really didn't have any experience. The whole paper office was in a room that maybe from the edge of that door over to here and back to about here. That would have been it, this corner, right, like this. And it had been, the union office had been a room like this, and they just partitioned it off so that Bill Escher would have a little counter to work on. There was a counter all along it. The old issues were under the counter. We had the subscriptions, and we mailed out, maybe 300 or 400 subscriptions by mail. And we had stuff for doing the headlines, and we typed it up on typewriters.
Typewriters.
Just manual typewriters.
How was the revenue now that, you know, you started getting the strike was started going, and, you know, you started losing some papers in some small
stores?
But
we were selling more in other stores. And once the strike started, especially up in Fresno County, Tulare County, outside the strike zone, if we didn't get thrown out of the stores, the subscriptions would go way up. And in fact, there was a store in Rich Grove that kicked us out, and everybody in Rich Grove read the newspaper, and they were all going to the other store, and they came back to Delano and asked us to bring the paper back. That had been a mistake. That was made us feel good.
You're doing a good job.
Yeah, a town like Rich Grove, everybody in the town, everybody read El Macriano. Everybody. Parlier, I bet our coverage in Parlier, I bet 80% of the families in Parlier read El Macriano. It was a farm worker town. Everybody there was farm workers. And they were all affected. And there might be people that didn't like the union for one reason or another, but everybody was affected. There was a letter in here real early that I think either Bill Escher or I think was a fake letter. Let me see if I can find it. But it was by a man who must eat, and it's a real powerful letter. And We Are Winning, and gosh, we started printing We Are Winning in October 1965. We're still saying it, but it's still a long way. Gosh. This is Whip to Jail. And this was a special section, Esquirola, Strike Breakers. And this was printed as a leaflet that could be taken out of El Macriado. This is in edition number 22. And hand it out. So this is in English and Spanish, definition of a strike breaker. Oh, and this is a letter from a scab, a man who must eat. And shall I read this into your thing? Dear editor, last year I came from Texas to work in the grapes near Delano for the first time. This year I came again, this time with my brother and a friend. When we came, we found the strike. But we saw that there were still some people working, so we worked too. I think Bill Escher wrote this. And they paid us better than they do in Texas. If I stop working now, I will lose my car because I am behind in the payments. I am a poor man. I can't afford to strike. Besides, a few of my friends are working. Why should they have working money and not me? I understand what the union's doing, and when they win, I will support them. I have talked to some of the strikers at the field. They were my own people, and they were fighting for everybody. But what can I do? I need money to live. When I don't work, I go hungry. I go hungry. Signed, a man who must eat. And whether Bill Escher wrote this or not, we heard this every day, 100 times from 1,000 people. I mean, it was just, that's, the strikebreakers weren't, you know, some kind of evil creature sent by the devil to destroy the union. They were our brothers and sisters that were people who must eat, Macriato said. But by this time, I think Bill's style was close to Caesar's, and he had absorbed Caesar's style. So that's why I say, oh, Caesar wrote this, Bill wrote this. I don't really know who wrote it.
Because both styles started.
But they had merged by that time.
And so then this was a response to...
Mm-hmm. Now Macriato says, "Dear man who must eat, all men must eat, you're not so special. We know you are hungry, and that your children are hungry. But if you think the only way to eat is to pick grapes around Delano, then we call you a liar and a fool. Mr. Man, you're sometimes hungry even when you are working. You're hungry in the winter when there's very little work. You're hungry if you live on surplus foods from the welfare. You've been hungry all your life. But have you ever been hungry for self-respect? This strike will win us a decent wage and a contract guaranteeing us work. If you cannot eat rice and beans now, by choice, chances are you will never eat well. We have always been poor and hungry because we have been too timid to ask for our rights. As long as we act like slaves, Patroncito will treat us like slaves. He will pay us as little as he can. He will raise the wage one day and lower it the next. It is time now to stand up and demand to be treated like human beings with the rights of American workers. Are you so hungry, man, that you will turn against your brother and steal his job to pay for your car? If your car is worth more to you than your self-respect, then you are our enemy. Yes, a few people are still working, because like you, they think only of today and not of tomorrow. But by picking grapes today, you are voting to stay poor and hungry. But by striking, you will soon win a decent wage. Some of those working are misinformed, some are foolish, some are cowards, and some are outright traitors to our people. But if you have any pride or honor, you will reject their actions. You must decide. You are either for us or against us, and we are either for you or against you. There is no middle ground." The strike really put the issue so clearly. Which side are you on? Are you on the side of the farm workers? You know, are you on the side of the people that produce food and are asking for a living wage? Or are you on the side of the growers that say, everything's fine? And when we took that question into the cities, to LA and San Francisco or so forth, it wasn't, are you communist or non-communist? Have you ever been a member? We were saying, which side are you on? The farm workers or the growers? And it meant that people from a tremendous spectrum of American society, whether politically of the left or dedicated Christians or people that like to eat, you know, and thought about where their food came from, it meant they could all come together. And we were asking the different question. It wasn't communist, non-communist. Right. It was, which side are you on, the farm workers or the growers? Mm-hmm. And it enabled us to build that coalition that in effect did an end run around the growers. We never could have won if we just stayed in Delano, if we just stayed in Kern County or Tulare County.
So that's one of the ideological markers that you use to bring in a larger group of people and to expand the movement, to expand the awareness, is taken away from this whole commie capitalist to, hey, you know, were you with the farm worker?
Right. And it was something that in the late 60s, you think of how tiny our union was, and yet when people came to Delano and met Caesar and Dolores and Gilbert, they were just so honest and so real, and they weren't living in rich houses, and they didn't have bank accounts, and if the strike failed, they weren't going to go back to Washington like like Al Green, you know, they were here forever. I mean, if the strike failed, there was nowhere to go.
Right.
We were part of it. And in that sense, I was different because I had parents back in Claremont. I could go back to Pomona. I could go back to the city, no problem for me. But for the huge community of people, there was nowhere to go. And we were staking our lives on it and asking you to help. Will you help us? And people said yes, from every walk of life. You know, Caesar and Dolores and Gilbert just hit a chord at a time when, and Kennedy had kind of lighted that spark. You know, there wasn't a new feeling and a new generation, and the civil rights movement had definitely started people thinking in terms of what do we really want this society to be like.
How did a lot of, you know, the war on poverty, the Johnson administration, help with, you know, organizing and influencing editorials and articles in the Macriado? You know, the war was going on.
Well, we didn't view the government as on our side at all. When the government intervened in agriculture at all, it was almost always against us, or almost always misguided. And we didn't see our salvation in politicians at all. And later, when Bobby Kennedy came along, we got involved in that campaign very much. And then once we joined the AFL-CIO, we were very involved in politics. But in these early issues of El Macriado, you almost always see the government is either
blindfolded
or against the workers. It's not on our side. Definitely not on our side. Don't put your hopes in the government. If you want to get ahead, organize. Well, I'm going to speed it up a little bit because all of this now is available for you to read. But we finished off the year. This issue's a mass. We're reaching out much more to the Christian community. Issue number 24, we printed a ship, The Grapes Are Rotting on the Docks. And this was the first indication. Again, you think of the impact of this paper in Parlier or Yedem or Dinuba. You know, this huge ship in San Francisco refusing to allow the grapes on board because the workers, the longshoremen, are picketing. Is there a picture in here? I guess the next issue has that. But picket stops ships carrying grapes. And just a very powerful reminder to people in these little villages that all of a sudden we're not alone. People are noticing us. And we have friends in unions, and we have friends in churches, and we have friends out there in the big wide world that are willing to help us. And this one, by the way, we got in trouble with the CP on this issue. Tyrants Look Foolish in Moscow, Mississippi, and Delano. Well, I remember CP people saying, how dare you compare Moscow to Mississippi? And, well, gosh, we always seem to be getting in trouble with somebody. But in part, El Macriado, that didn't bother El Macriado because our persona was we stepped on toes. We shot spit wads at the priest, you know. We were the bad boy. And so, yeah, people were always mad at us. This has a moving letter from Manuel Rivera. And he wrote this. And so your Spanish, when you're reading it, if there are misspellings and so forth in this, it's because that's the way he wrote it. And this has an open letter from Caesar that I think certainly Caesar would have written. In fact, you'll see in some points we defend ourselves for our misspellings because we didn't go to college, we didn't go to school. And if our Spanish has some errors, our facts are correct, even if our spelling isn't. And this is Caesar pleading for negotiations. And this is the first mention of the Teatro Campesino.
That was volume...
This is volume number 25. This would have been like November of 1965.
65.
and the Christmas issue. And Andy didn't do this. I think Luis Valdez may have done this picture, or I'm not sure who. And it might mention, but we didn't give credit in the paper to.
It was a collective effort.
Mm-hmm. When you begin seeing things like this, this is my influence. I've cut, instead of cutting stuff out from Alarma, I tended to cut it out from other things. Yeah, this would have been the kind of thing that I would put in the paper, a little bunny under the mistletoe. But Delano needs doctors. Even in the midst of the strike, we're saying there's so much more than wages. There's a whole community that needs to be turned around and changed.
A couple issues back, you say there's a mass and we're reaching out to Christians. One of the things I always look at whenever I'm by a bookcase is I always scan the titles real quick, and I notice back over here there's an interesting collection of works behind them, including the Quran. There's some of the, well, I would say some of the, look like a couple of things from the current or more current feminist spirituality. Where are you? What has been your path, in terms of your theological orientation, your spiritual orientation?
I grew up as an Episcopalian, and went to the Episcopal Church once in Delano. They were bitterly opposed to the strike and said it was all outside agitators and that the farm workers were well paid and happy, and they were collecting old clothes and rags for the poor people in Corcoran. That's the once and last and only time I went to the Episcopal Church in Delano. Once I was part of the union, I felt much more comfortable going to the union religious service, whatever it was, which was usually Catholic. But the Catholic Church in 1965 was very, very conservative. And when the strike broke out, as I remember, there were 5 priests in California that could be counted on to help the union, and Caesar knew them all personally. And we got in touch with them right away. One of them gave a Volkswagen bus, which the Macriato used to distribute the paper later. Father Garcia, maybe from Brentwood or somewhere. But it was a little, they all knew each other.
Yeah.
And for the entire rest of the Catholic Church, there was no concern at all with the problems of farm workers. And in fact, at various different times, bishops would forbid priests to go to Delano and say the Mass because they were outside agitators. And the local bishop was opposed to that because a lot of his revenue came from the Italian and Croatian growers. And when I was growing up in Virginia, every church service, morning prayer, we always said, love thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and